Welcome to Two-Way Street. Emory University's Center for Ethics has just begun a year-long celebration of the 200th anniversary of the publication of Mary Shelley's classic novel, Frankenstein. The actual anniversary takes place on January 1st next year. But 2 weeks ago, the center kicked off the celebration with a program at the Schwartz Center for the Performing Arts. I was asked to play a role that night. I was invited to interview the Atlanta-based portrait artist who the center commissioned to paint a portrait of what Frankenstein's monster might have looked like. You'll hear that conversation a little later in the show. But first, Center for Ethics Director Paul Root Wolpe kicked off the evening with an explanation of why he believes the novel is worthy of so much attention 200 years after its publication.
And she created this imagined creature, which is, I believe, the most well-known and famous character ever created by a woman in literature. Frankenstein is known throughout the world. There is no country with a major film industry that has not made a Frankenstein film. But because of the novel's success in spawning such an incredible industry of Frankenstein, everything's from movies to video games to toys, most of us don't really remember that the novel itself is not about the creation of a creature. No, the novel's about something else entirely. It's about the responsibility of creation. It's about hubris and cowardice. Victor Frankenstein is not a very nice person, not one to admire. It's about the fear and retribution of the creature. It's about aesthetics and disability. It's about rejection and otherness and the limits and responsibilities of science. In fact, it speaks to us in 2017 in ways that one couldn't even imagine it could speak to us back in 1818, and the genius of the book is that it is at least as relevant, if not more relevant today, than when it was written.
But the idea for the novel had much less ambitious roots. In 1816, Mary Shelley, who was just 18 years old, went on an outing with her husband, the poet Percy Shelley, to Lake Geneva, Switzerland. They were joined there by other notable English writers of the day. Years later, Shelley wrote about how the idea for Frankenstein was birthed during that trip. Here's Emory University theater professor Lisa Paulson reading from Shelley's words.
I shall give a general answer to the question so frequently asked me. How I, then a young girl, came to think of and dilate upon so very hideous an idea. In the summer of 1816, we visited Switzerland and became the neighbors of Lord Byron. It proved a wet, ungenial summer, and incessant rain often confined us for days to the house. We will each write a ghost story, said Lord Byron, and his proposition was acceded to. I busied myself to think of a story to rival those which had excited us to this task, one which would speak to the mysterious fears of our nature and awaken thrilling horror, one to make the reader dread to look around, to curdle the blood and quicken the beatings of the heart. If I did not accomplish these things, my ghost story would be unworthy of its name. I thought and pondered vainly. I felt that blank incapability of invention, which is the greatest misery of authorship, when dull nothing replies to our anxious invocations. Have you thought of a story? I was asked each morning, and each morning I was forced to reply with a mortifying negative. Night waned upon this talk, and even the witching hour had gone by before we retired to rest. When I placed my head on my pillow, I did not sleep, nor could I be said to think. My imagination, unbidden, possessed and guided me, gifting the successive images that arose in my mind with a vividness far beyond the usual bounds of reverie. I saw, with shut eyes but acute mental vision, I saw the pale student of unhallowed arts kneeling beside the thing he had put together. I saw the hideous phantasm of a man stretched out. And then, on the working of some powerful engine, show signs of life and stir with an uneasy, half-vital motion. Frightful must it be, for supremely frightful would be the effect of any human endeavor to mock the stupendous mechanism of the creator of the world. His success would terrify the artist. He would rush away from his odious handiwork, horror-stricken. He would hope that, left to itself, the slight spark of life which he had communicated would fade, that this thing which had received such imperfect animation would subside into dead matter, and he might sleep in the belief that the silence of the grave would quench forever the transient existence of the hideous corpse which he had looked upon as the cradle of life. He sleeps, but he is wakened and opens his eyes. Behold, the horrid thing stands at his bedside, opening his curtains and looking on him with yellow, watery, but speculative eyes. I open mine in terror. The idea so possessed my mind that a thrill of fear ran through me, and I wished to exchange the ghastly image of my fancy for the realities around. I see them still. The very room, the dark parquet, the closed shutters with the moonlight struggling through, and the sense I had that the glassy lake and white high Alps were beyond. I could not so easily get rid of my hideous phantom. Still, it haunted me. I must try to think of something else. It recurred to my ghost story, my tiresome, unlucky ghost story. Oh, if I could only contrive one which would frighten my reader as I myself had been frightened that night.
The book, which is formally titled Frankenstein, the Modern Prometheus, tells the story of the young university student Victor Frankenstein who abandons his studies to find a method for creating life. Over the two centuries since it was published, the book has inspired playwrights, filmmakers, and other writers to tell the cautionary tale of what can happen when humans aspire to hold creation in their hands.
It's alive! It's alive!
When that first major motion picture version of Frankenstein opened in December of 1931, starring Boris Karloff as the monster, it thrilled and terrified audiences. The critic for the New York Times called it spine-chilling, and he wrote that, quote, "It aroused so much excitement that many in the audience laughed to cover their true feelings." Ironically, what may be the most famous scene from that movie and so many other Frankenstein films, the birth of the monster, doesn't even appear in Shelley's novel. As you'll hear in this reading from the book by Brent Glenn of Theodore Emery, Shelley wrote the actual creation of the monster as a before and after narrative, skipping the moment when it comes to life. She focuses on Victor Frankenstein's immediate revulsion when he sees what he's created.
No one can conceive the variety of feelings which bore me onwards like a hurricane in the first enthusiasm of success. Life and death appeared to me ideal bounds which I should first break through and pour a torrent of light into our dark world. A new species would bless me as its creator and source. Many happy and excellent natures would owe their being to me. No father could claim the gratitude of his child so completely as I should deserve theirs. Pursuing these reflections, I thought that if I could bestow animation upon lifeless matter, I might, in process of time, although I now found it impossible, renew life where death had apparently devoted the body to corruption. One secret which I alone possessed was the hope to which I had dedicated myself. And the moon gazed on my midnight labors while, with unrelaxed and breathless eagerness, I pursued nature to her hiding places. Who shall conceive the horrors of my secret toil as I dabbled among the unhallowed damps of the grave or tortured the living animal to animate the lifeless clay? My limbs now tremble and my eyes swim with the remembrance, but then, A resistless and almost frantic impulse urged me forward. I seemed to have lost all soul or sensation but for this one pursuit. It was on a dreary night of November that I beheld the accomplishment of my toils. With an anxiety that almost amounted to agony, I collected the instruments of life around me that I might infuse a spark of being into the lifeless thing that lay at my feet. It was already 1 a.m. The rain pattered dismally against the panes, and my candle was nearly burnt out when, by the glimmer of the half-extinguished light, I saw the dull yellow eye of the creature open. It breathed hard, and a convulsive motion agitated its limbs. How can I describe my emotions at this catastrophe? Or how delineate the wretch whom with such infinite pains and care I had endeavored to form? His limbs were in proportion, and I had selected his features as beautiful.
Beautiful. Great God.
His yellow skin scarcely covered the work of muscles and arteries beneath. His hair was of a lustrous black and flowing, his teeth of a pearly whiteness, but these luxuriances only formed a more horrid contrast with his watery eyes that seemed almost of the same color as the dun-white sockets in which they were set, his shriveled complexion and straight black lips. The different accidents of life are not so changeable as the feelings of human nature. I had worked hard for nearly 2 years for the sole purpose of infusing life into an inanimate body. For this, I had deprived myself of rest and health. I had desired it with an ardor that far exceeded moderation. But now that I had finished, the beauty of the dream vanished, and breathless horror and disgust filled my heart. Unable to endure the aspect of the being I had created, I rushed out of the room and continued a long time traversing my bedchamber, unable to compose my mind to sleep. At length, lassitude succeeded to the tumult I had before endured, and I threw myself on the bed in my clothes, endeavoring to seek a few moments of forgetfulness. But it was in vain. I slept indeed, but I was disturbed by the wildest dreams. I started from my sleep with horror. A cold dew covered my forehead, my teeth chattered, and every limb became convulsed when, by the dim and yellow light of the moon, as it forced its way through the window shutters, I beheld the wretch, the miserable monster whom I had created. He held up the curtain of the bed, and his eyes, if eyes they may be called, were fixed on me. His jaws opened, and he muttered some inarticulate sounds while a grin wrinkled his cheeks. He might have spoken, but I did not hear. One hand was stretched out, seemingly to detain me, but I escaped and rushed downstairs. I took refuge in the courtyard belonging to the house where I inhabited, where I remained during the rest of the night, walking up and down in the greatest agitation, listening attentively, catching and fearing each sound as if it were to announce the approach of the demoniacal corpse to which I had so miserably given life. Oh, no mortal could support the horror of that countenance. A mummy, again endued with animation, could not be so hideous as that wretch. I had gazed on him while unfinished. He was ugly then. But when those muscles and joints were rendered capable of motion, it became a thing such as even Dante could not have conceived.
In writing the novel, Mary Shelley made a decision that allows the reader's imagination to take flight. She doesn't give the monster a name, and she never provides a description of what he looks like. But as part of the 200th anniversary celebration, the Center for Ethics asked Atlanta-based portrait artist Ross Rawson to create a large-scale portrait of the monster. I'll talk to Rawson about how he went about that task after a break. This is Two Way Street.
Thank you.
If you're just joining us, we're sharing portions of a program that the Emory University Center for Ethics held recently to launch their year-long celebration of the 200th anniversary of the publication of Mary Shelley's novel Frankenstein. The Shelley novel is far different from the best-known movie versions of the book. It presents a series of ethical questions about the impact of hatred and bigotry, about whether elements like compassion and intellect are necessary to define us as human, and much more. As part of the celebration, the center commissioned well-known Atlanta artist Ross Rawson to create a portrait of the monster. Since moving to Atlanta from his native Bulgaria 17 years ago, Rawson's established himself as a premier portrait artist. His paintings of Andrew Young, Morgan Freeman, Hank Aaron, and Maya Angelou hang in the National Portrait Gallery, and the Angelou family selected Rawson's painting for the U.S. postage stamp created in the poet's honor. Rawson also created the new statue of Hank Aaron that sits at SunTrust Park. As part of the evening celebrating the Frankenstein anniversary, I was invited to talk with Rawson about how he created his portrait of the monster, which he, as you'll hear, modeled after his 18-year-old son. If you can get to the internet from where you're listening to today's show, we've posted the portrait Rawson painted on our Facebook page, so you can see it as we talk. You asked a question in an interview that you had some time ago, I think with the AJC, Kevin Riley, who's here tonight. I think you raised the question as he talked to you about why is this book, why is this story 200 years later still completely captivating to us? How do you answer that question?
Because we all, regardless how happy we are in our lives, regardless how successful, inevitably, at one point in our lives, in different degree, we experience hatred. And that's very important and to know. We either personally experience it, or we have it in our hearts, have hatred. We have to admit it, or we see it, at least. We witness it, and we become numb at some point to witnessing hatred in our country, in our community, in the world, tragedy every day. We almost get numb, and that's tragic. That's why Frankenstein will be irrelevant forever, because unfortunately, negativity and hatred will exist.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, even beyond just the way in which the monster is treated, and I was startled when I came across this, because I have no memory of it from reading the novel previously. There's even a storyline in the novel that deals with bigotry against Muslims. And I was stunned when I came across it. People who have read the book will know what I'm talking about. If not, you should read it, and you'll see that there's a character, a Turkish man, who is treated he's treated with hatred simply because of his religion. That really struck me as being remarkable, given what we're living through now.
Unbelievable! So early, we're talking 1818. All right, this is amazing. Of course,
you chose to make the monster really young. How old is your son?
18 and a half, yeah.
18 and a half.
Mm-hmm.
This monster is not much older than your son, is he?
Yes. Again, going back to Mary Shelley, she was 19 when she conceived the idea. So she was wise, she was very mature, but she was also very, very young. I mean, frightfully young when she decided to do something so monumentally important. The idea, I mean, let's not forget that Victor Frankenstein's idea was to create something new, something wonderful, something great. That's why he was called the Prometheus in the title. I keep going back to this tragic occurrence of events in human history, which I personally experienced, and many of us experience one way or another. So many beautiful things start young and fresh, with beautiful ideas, social new changes and systems that go ugly eventually, go bloody, right? Go terrible. Here's your different dimension. But at the beginning, they're young. So he must have been young because of Mary, because of the idea of Victor Frankenstein.
The monster is animated. And we can see in your portrait that I'm imagining, when I look at your portrait, this is not the monster as he is initially animated. This is what the monster develops into physically over a period of time. And let me tell you why I'm suggesting that, and you respond to it. When the monster is first animated, he looks to Frankenstein as a father, as a someone who he needs to look up to, who he wants to bond with, who he cares about. He can't help. It's not his fault that Frankenstein rejects him so entirely, so quickly. So my guess is the monster initially doesn't quite look like this portrait, yes?
Yes, naturally. None of us, when we are born, everybody's innocent and quite cute. Eventually, experiencing so much negativity and rejection, many of our society turn into monsters.
He is trying, and this is where certainly the ethical aspects of the story come into play in a big way. The journey that Mary Shelley takes him on is one of what does it mean to become human in the real world. He does not start as human, but he observes behavior in the world. He sees kindness in the world. He begins to learn language. He actually starts to read books like Paradise Lost. He's becoming a prescient being who wants to be fully engaged in the world around him.
Yeah, and you see, that's even more tragic because he sees what he doesn't have. See, he understands what's denied to him. And little by little, he turns into a murderous machine. But we must not forget that he's very intelligent. He speaks fluent. Only within 11 months or so, he speaks fluent German and French. Towards the end of the book, he already speaks English. He certainly knows more languages than I do. And he's very eloquent. And that's why one of the distinction which I make between my work and the early movies they made about him, it's like a mute, imbecile creature that barely talks and walks. This is not exactly the case. And that makes this character all the more tragic and complex and asking for understanding.
Frankenstein becomes only the first of many people who are repulsed by him and reject him. And he does eventually, as you say, become a murderer. He ends up raging against a world that will not accept him. You know what I thought was interesting about that, before we actually turned to how you did the portrait? We are, of course, told over and over again in the book about how lonely the monster is, how much he desires affection. He actually threatens Victor Frankenstein when he confronts him at one point that if he doesn't create a mate, he'll probably kill Frankenstein or engage in violent behavior against some of Frankenstein's family. So he, we know, is intensely lonely. But as I read the book, it occurred to me they're both immensely lonely creatures. They're both locked in to their own loneliness. And they have a symbiotic relationship that is really powerful because neither of them has any, neither of them can get any solace out of this relationship.
I think that's a great point you're making. Thank you for doing that. Victor Frankenstein, in my opinion, is just as tragic as his creation. He, not for a moment in the book, he realizes that he needs his creature. He needs him closer to himself, regardless how repulsive he is, regardless how disappointing the experiment turns. He needs him just as much. And that never happens, and the tragedy is right there, and that's what we don't understand. As very quick to reject, very quick to say no, very quick to say goodbye or discriminate. We don't understand that we need that person that doesn't think like us, that doesn't look like us, but we need him, we need her, we need them, and that's critically important to understand. I hope that's one of the ideas that are intertwined into this work.
Okay, so these all these themes came into play in your thinking about the creature and how you'd finally envision him and paint him. But before we get to just what you've done on the canvas, your technique is really interesting. I read an article about you a while back. We know you're fascinated and have done portraits of United States presidents. We know you've done Hank Aaron, Andy Young, Maya Angelou, whose family chose your image of her to be on the U.S. postage stamp. I mean, you have a remarkable career.
Thank you.
And we should acknowledge it.
Thank you.
But I was struck by something you said to an interviewer, I think it's a while ago, about a portrait you did of Abraham Lincoln. I think the interviewer asked you whether you'd gone to see the Daniel Day-Lewis picture. What'd you say at that time? You hadn't, and there was a reason you hadn't. Why?
Again, for the same reason. I want to keep my relations with Abe Lincoln and my models pristine and pure and clean and with no influence, because they're very special relations. You see, making a portrait is not just depicting someone who's sitting in front of you and merely copying the physical object or the character or anything. Much more than that, it's a process. It's a dialogue which I have with my model. It's about my relations with my model, and so to a large extent, every portrait is also a self-portrait in that sense. So that's why I would rather abstain from any influences of any kind. I will isolate myself, kind of a method actor, if you will. I would love to understand and see my angle to that particular object I'm trying to depict.
Okay, so I was just, that was interesting. We won't go into how you came up with your image of Lincoln, but it relates to this. Again, excuse me. How do you commune with the monster? What is your process? Are you sitting in a dark room with your eyes closed? I mean, what happened? Yeah. You know, you've worked with many models, live models. You've worked with photographs of various people whose portraits you've done. In this case, you had nothing in terms of physical, a physical model to work with. How are you communing with this?
Yeah, well, almost nothing. I spent with the model, 18 and a half something years together. So he's my own son, and I've, that was the very initial idea I had in mind when we had the initial conversation about Frankenstein. I knew he's gonna be my model for that same reasons. You see, creator, creation.
You're sort of
something's
his Adam.
Going on. Yeah. but then again, the dark part, the dark side, is when he left the room. We already surrounded myself with sketches and pictures and everything, and I was alone, and started changing his face. So it's not exactly the easiest time and process to make your beautiful son's face ugly, hideously ugly. And he's a handsome boy. I mean, I must admit it. But and now when he saw the finished work, he deeply regrets participating in this project. He said, "No, that was a mistake." Clearly, anyway. But obviously, at some point, I forget that's Michael. It's not Michael anymore. It's like a broken mirror, and I started adding changing everything with anger and pain and frustration, which was in me, basically. Experiencing whatever I experienced for 53 years in this world, political and social and economical changes, you know, in different countries, different continents, changing lifestyles and living as an artist, this is not exactly the funniest thing and the easiest thing on earth, and experience so many situations in life when I could see a little bit too much drama.
Is your pain and anger, is that reflected?
Inevitably. At some point, you have to understand, I use brushes, obviously, and paint. There is nothing really There is no secret. It's a classical painting. You see the same technique in the museums, no different. But the truth is, at some point, you don't paint with brushes and paints. You paint with blood and tears. This is how it works, all right? Everything that's here goes there. This is how it works.
Okay, well, this isn't a confessional, but you're a very thoughtful guy, obviously. What are some of the things that you struggle with? What's some of the pain that we see in this painting that you've dealt with? I'm really not trying to get into your intimate life, but I'm wondering if it operates on a social level somewhere.
I'm having a hard time dealing with the fact that millions of people are dying as we speak and suffer tremendously as we speak. And we almost don't pay attention or very quickly judge one situation and another, celebrate one leader or another, which he or she doesn't deserve this celebration. And being an artist means nothing else but being super sensitive, ultra sensitive about things. So caring about the other fellow humans, caring about the misfortune in the world is just enough reason to go and do something like this.
I'm really glad you said that, because when I first looked at your portrait, what I really saw in the monster, and of course, the joy of being a portrait artist is you get to hear different people react differently. We read into it what we want to see in some ways. But I see less hatred in that face and more pain and sadness. Do you feel I'm right about that? Well, is that what the dominant feeling is?
Hatred is the cause. Pain is the result. So you should be able to go beyond the pain and beyond the obvious ugliness and even the murderous acts and see what caused all this. So I hope, not just this work, but any art piece, any beautiful music, help us to liberate ourselves from hatred and to have zero tolerance to hatred. That's what all art is all about anyway.
But sadness is a more dominant emotion in your monster than is the rage, which leads him to kill a number of people, innocent people, yes?
Sadly, yes. I mean, obviously, had he enjoyed normal human love and acceptance, he would have been different, despite his kind of monstrous look and everything. The look doesn't really matter. It's all about the soul. I travel to India every year and roam the streets in various cities and various streets and try to communicate and take pictures of all kinds of folks on the street who, for one simple reason, they have absolutely nothing, nothing material, nothing remotely close to what we all have. But they have themselves, and they have their faith, and they have their God, they have their spirit, their connection with the universe. They have this unique sense of oneness of the universe. There is no such thing here. There is no oneness of the universe.
Yeah, I mean, that's really an important point. You're right. The eyes are so empty, which raises one of the questions that is part of the ethical conversation about the novel. He is striving to be human. He's learning all of the aspects, mimicking what human behavior is. But is he human? Your portrait suggests probably not. Does he have a soul? When I look at his eyes, I say no.
You see, there are a lot of people who are not humans, who don't necessarily have soul. I know I've seen animals that have more soul than some people.
We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, more with artist Ross Rawson. He was invited to paint a portrait of Frankenstein's monster as part of Emory University's celebration of the 200th anniversary of the publication of Mary Shelley's novel. Let's get back to our conversation with Atlanta portrait artist Ross Rawson. Rossett and I talked in front of a live audience at Emory Schwartz Center for the Performing Arts as part of the kickoff of Emory University's celebration of the publication of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. When Mary Shelley wrote the novel, there were aspects of working on this novel that haunted her, that entered into her dreams. She was possessed by it. As you transformed your handsome young college-bound freshman son into this horrible monster, did it possess you in that way at all, emotionally? Did it grip you? Did it enter your dreams? Did it frighten you? How did you react emotionally as you started this transformation?
Honestly, I was surprised to... I wasn't... No, it didn't do anything bad to me. On the contrary, it actually, in a way, changed me. It made me understand, have better understanding of people who very quickly we can call criminals. We can quickly, judge, for their behavior, and made me think, you know what? I mean, spending some time with him and him coming closer and closer to me day after day after day, and at some point he basically is right here on the easel, one-on-one. He literally came from the nothingness, came to life in the studio, and I think he made me a better person.
So let's talk technique. And let's answer a question that I know you get asked all the time, or a comment that is made about your work, and I want to get your response because I know you have a good one. People say about your work, and some people will see the portraits that are on display upstairs at the Schwartz Center, examples of your work. Gee, you do photorealistic work. Your paintings look like photographs. Your answer to that is?
the photographs try to look like my paintings.
but you really mean something by
I really
that.
Mean it.
What do you mean by that?
I really mean it, and I say this with proper respect to our fellow artist photographers. Now, just because there is something magical about the human hand. You see, the connection between the human mind and the human heart and the hand. You see, as accurate as it looks, and the portrait as accurate as they look, they're not that accurate, actually. There are thousands, maybe tens of thousands, tiny little mistakes, quote to quote, which make it different from the photograph, make it different from reality, because the soul of the artist is there because of it is handmade, for that simple technical reason, okay? Inevitably, no matter the training and the whatever ability, talent, whatever, still it is handmade. Therefore, it is unique. It is special. So, regardless how realistic it looks, it has certain vibration there and certain element of soul and personal touch and personal presence that makes it unique. Unlike in photography, you have this moment missing, basically. It's mechanical, no matter how great the photographer, and there are great photographers out there, I'm not saying anything, but it's still inevitably limited. It's mechanical to a certain point. You click, you print, that's about it.
You've said that every single little detail, as you're doing a portrait, can alter what the look is, who the person is. Yeah. So that you've said a little corner of the mouth downturned, an eyebrow at a different angle. Help us understand what that means, and can we see that in this painting?
You see, human face, the reason I do portraits is human face is unique in that sense. It's like a piece of symphony, like orchestra. Every element works, every element matters. Everything is connected to everything else. You see, the tiniest change of the position of the eyebrow changes the expression, changes the character, changes the message, the energy of the face.
Okay, as I look at the painting, so for instance, there are drops of water or sweat coming down the monster's face really in his lower face particularly. And I'm just curious, where did that come from? Why did you decide to do that?
It just occurred to me that will add more drama and more more to the pain.
Okay.
You see?
Yeah.
You see, it gets even beyond. There's something more is going on. He's coming from somewhere, going somewhere. Something's not right. And that additionally conveys those same
right.
sentiments.
So you add details like that because mm-hmm. you do want to have a sense of drama. It tells us something perhaps about the journey, even if it isn't necessarily accurate to what your vision of his actual face looks like.
Precisely.
Fair enough?
Precisely. Going back to the photographs trying to look like paintings.
Yeah, right. Okay, so you have established this remarkable reputation for portraiture. I was curious, when I look at some of your work, I wonder if how you view the work of other portrait artists that might be familiar to us in who are here tonight. So for instance, I'm wondering, when you look at Chuck Close's work, that photorealistic,
right,
also
right, right.
extreme though close, he brings us right on
right.
top of the faces. What do you think when you see a Chuck Close, for instance, and how it's different from what you do?
Well, first of all, I have a great admiration of his work. I'm a huge fan, naturally, one of the biggest names in our time, and
yeah.
I grew up with looking into his work, and he inspires me. But that's about it. Everything else is different. And the reason is, when you stand in front of Close's work, there is this barrier, like a glass wall of cold distance. No matter how close you get, his models are still distant.
That's really remarkable. You're right. We're so close,
yes.
but we're not.
True, true. And he intends to do that. That's his genius. That's his thing. And that's his message and everything, a statement, artistic statement. I'm trying to do exactly the opposite. I invite my viewers to go inside, into the mind of my models, to take this journey into one's psyche and see what's going deep, deep, deep down there, so intimately, so uniquely perfect in a sense that I think that's the major difference between my work and his work.
Yeah, yeah. So that's interesting too, this notion of getting deeper and deeper and seeing deeper into the soul of your subject. So that raises, again, Center for Ethics here, that raises a question for me. Are there ethics involved in how you choose to create a portrait? Can you go out of bounds in finding too much truth? Or are you a journalist who under any circumstances must reveal the truth of a subject you're painting?
You see, you just answered your own question. I'm just like you. I'm a journalist. I have to do it. I have to go there. That's why you and I go to hell, all right? It's not that. It's not ethical.
That's got to be painful.
But somebody sometimes. Needs to go there, all right? Somebody needs to do it, right?
Well, I mean, look, we're well aware over in history of any number of portrait artists who have created works that the person who's sitting for the portrait has rejected out of hand because there was either too much truth or not enough semblance of reality there. All
that's
right.
it, yeah, but okay, that's the choice we make in our life. And
that's brave. There's a certain bravery to being willing
true.
To go there,
mm-hmm.
I think, isn't there?
It is, because the deeper you go, the more you understand the divine nature of all of us, literally all of us, and this is so beautiful and so perfect, and then you have to go back home, and life itself is less than perfect.
Yeah.
The mundane aspect of life is less than perfect. And that bothers you. You want to go back there. You need that drug. You need that connection with the divine aspect. You need that meditation. And that's one of the things you never realize when you start the journey from the beginning.
And that's also another, takes us back to Frankenstein. The monster is striving for perfection. He's striving for the divine. He understands the spark of the divine based on all he's learning out in the world, and yet he's continually brought back to the reality of an ugliness around him that eventually turns him evil and brings him down.
Isn't that amazing?
It's, yeah.
That's basically the artist's life.
Well, Ross Russin, I'm struck by how the book Frankenstein made you think, as you said, about aspects of life that you had not thought about before, made you perhaps more empathetic, more compassionate. And I think what we all owe you as we look at your portrait is thanks for doing the same thing. The portrait of what the world has turned your monster into, it strikes me, ought to remind us of just how much impact hatred, bigotry, mistrust can have on a creature, human or not. Thank you for your remarkable work.
Thank you.
Ross Russin's portrait of the Frankenstein monster is currently on public display at the William Schwartz Center for the Performing Arts on the Emory University campus. We'll post a photo of the work on our website at gpb.org/TWS. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, you can find it on our Facebook page, too. Mary Shelley was surrounded by untimely deaths throughout her life. Her mother died shortly after she was born. Her half-sister Fanny committed suicide in 1816, around the same time that Mary Shelley began thinking about writing Frankenstein. And Percy Shelley's first wife, to whom he was still married when he and Mary took up together, also committed suicide. Once she and Percy were married, they suffered the deaths of three children. Finally, in 1822, Percy Shelley drowned in a boating accident in Italy. He left Mary a widow at the age of 24, and while she continued writing her own works, she devoted a good part of the rest of her life to making sure her husband's poetry would be published. Mary died of brain cancer in 1851. She was 53 years old, but Frankenstein, the new Prometheus, continues as her lasting legacy. Given the gothic nature of the novel, it made sense that the Center for Ethics celebration included an organ solo. Emory organist Timothy Albrecht performed Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor. Before we leave you, a few words about conversations coming up on Two Way Street this fall. The great singer-songwriter Jimmy Webb will visit with us. He wrote some of America's most beloved songs, Wichita Lineman, By the Time I Get to Phoenix, Galveston, and many others were made famous by his creative partner Glenn Campbell. MacArthur Park became a hit when Richard Harris sang the song. The Fifth Dimension had a huge hit with Webb's Up, Up, and Away, and everybody from Frank Sinatra to Barbara Streisand recorded his hit, Didn't We?
We almost made the pieces fit.
Didn't we? This time we almost made some sense of it. Didn't we?
We'll also be talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Gary Wills about his book on the Quran. Wills is known for his scholarly writing about Christianity. In this book, he looks at the controversies, the misunderstandings, and the real teachings of the Quran. And we've also got a show coming up with Lynn Rosetta Casper. She's about to retire after 2 decades as host of The Splendid Table on NPR. We'll talk about her life and career. All of that and more is ahead on Two Way Street. That's it for our show this week. Our senior producer is Jenny Ament. Jenny edited this week's show. Our associate producer is Olivia Rheingold. Tyler Morris is our engineer. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for listening today. I hope to see you again next week for another Two-Way Street.